This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, an update on the protests that have racked both Iraq and Lebanon. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. According to The Economist magazine, if it were not for the respective national flags being waved, it would be difficult to tell the difference between the protests in Lebanon and those in Iraq. In Baghdad, as in Beirut, masses of people have taken to the streets, angry over corruption, poor governance, and the lack of jobs. Thousands have also come out in cities such as Basra and Karbala, in Iraq's Shia-dominated south, the government's heartland. However, unlike in Lebanon, at least so far, the protests in Iraq have been met with extreme violence. Iraqi security forces and their allied militias have killed at least 250 people since the turmoil began on October 1. However, unlike Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri, Iraqi Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mahdi has not stepped down. Analysts say that Mahdi's removal is unlikely anyway to satisfy the protesters. People have benefited little from record oil production. About one-fifth of the population in Iraq is poor, and instead of helping them, politicians enrich themselves and their militias. Much of the public's anger has focused on those militias or popular mobilization forces and their patron, Iran. Meantime, a new slogan ignites Iraqis: Free, free Iraq, Iran, get out. They indicate that they want to change the entire system of governance. They say they are engaged in Tharwa, the Arabic word for revolution. In Lebanon, it was a proposed tax on calls via the messaging service WhatsApp, which triggered protesters to finally take to the streets. In Lebanon, as many as 1 million people have joined the protests in a country with fewer than 5 million citizens. Mr. Hariri's departure is unlikely to persuade the demonstrators to end their campaign. Hariri's government struggled to perform the most basic tasks, such as providing adequate electricity or drinkable water. Internet connections in Lebanon are among the world's slowest. Rubbish often piles up in the streets or is dumped in the Mediterranean. The Lebanese protesters, like their Iraqi counterparts, also believe they are engaged in a revolution. Well, joining us to compare and contrast the protest movements in Iraq and Lebanon are two distinguished regional analysts. Ellen Lapson is a professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University. That's a college based in the nearby state of Virginia. And Les Campbell, he is Senior Associate and Regional Director for Middle East and North Africa Programs at the National Democratic Institute. And that's a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that works with partners in developing countries to increase the effectiveness of democratic institutions. And he just returned from Lebanon. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Glad to be with you, Carol.
Well, Les Campbell, let me begin with you because you just came back from Lebanon and you have your finger on the pulse of what's going on in Iraq. What do you think are the primary factors behind the protests in both places?
The protests in Iraq and Lebanon are driven from the same impulse that drives smaller versions of unrest in Morocco, where teachers have been striking, Algeria, where people have been on the streets every Friday, I think almost since January, even in places like Jordan, which are, you know, more stable and you normally don't see protests. You've had people marching, camping outside the royal court, asking for reform. They're also against certain types of tax increases. So the whole region has a surge of demand. People are just tired of the status quo. They want change. And they want a better future, they want more say in their future. But I think what sets Iraq and Lebanon apart, and I think why it's a bit more spectacular, is that there is a sectarian aspect to it. You know, both countries have political systems which are very much informed and structured according to the religious sect that people belong to. There's a sense that these political systems are very restrictive, that change is more difficult, you know, at least in, say, Morocco and Jordan, there's a certain responsiveness. But I think in Iraq and Lebanon, people feel that the system is sort of calcified and they're on the streets saying they're sick and tired of it. But like most political movements, I think at the heart of all this is economics. I mean, people the pocketbooks are hurting Lebanon. Its inflation is rising. Banks don't have currency. There are controls on how much you can take out of the bank. It's hard to get any hard currency in Iraq. You know, jobs are hard to find for young people. No one knows the exact unemployment rate, but among young people, it may be 40%. It may be higher. At its heart, it's economic. But to get to economic answers, people realize that their political system has to change.
Turning to you, Ellen, for your take on the common denominators of the protests, particularly in Iraq and Lebanon.
So, Carol, I like to put this in even maybe a larger frame, which is the Arab Spring. It began in 2011 with the fall of regimes in Tunisia and Egypt. It then mutated into very violent civil wars in Yemen and Syria. But the quick conclusion was that, oh, well, those valiant young people in the Arab world tried, but they failed, and it's over. Well, I never thought the Arab Spring was over. I thought that it was the beginning of a shift of mindset of whether people do think they have the voice to expect more of their governments. And so I really find it very powerful and compelling, even though it may not produce results in the short run. But I think it's quite a powerful human story to see people in these distinct countries saying, we're not satisfied. And I completely agree with Les that there's a fundamental base that's economic grievance. But I'm kind of fascinated by the political ideas that are circulating here. Les mentioned that the sectarian dimension has come out. And what I find particularly interesting about that is young Lebanese and Iraqis, and I shouldn't say they're all young, there's people of many ages participating in this, they want to go back to a national identity that isn't based on sect. And they resent that the political elites of their country have sort of frozen this sectarian identity as almost more important than national identity. So I find it quite compelling that the United States, after all, thought we were doing them a favor by writing a constitution that had some built-in protections for minorities, but it created a political culture that actually encouraged corruption because each of these groups feels that they own a share of the spoils of the country rather than having to compete on the merits of their ideas. And I think people really are looking for a cleaner, more open, more transparent political set of choices where they can choose on the merits of an individual political actor, not on their sectarian identity.
Exactly. Well, you were referring to the United States helping Iraq in 2003 create a new constitution. So let's go to Iraq, Les Campbell, to talk about how primarily Shia protesters are taking to the streets and to what extent they do represent a cross-section of other groups, the Sunni, the Kurds, and how important it is that they, that is the Shia Muslims, are taking on the predominantly Shia-led government of al-Mahdi, and what they're asking for.
Well, I mentioned a couple of things first, just a little background on this. My organization, NDIR, the National Democratic Institute, we've conducted polling in Iraq almost since 2003, but very consistently over the last 12 years. And over these last 12 years, sectarianism has been subsiding or decreasing. More and more, when people are asked the same question, basically, do you describe yourself as Sunni, Shia, or Iraqi? People are saying Iraqi more than they have in the past. This sort of sense of a national Iraqi identity has been growing, not dropping. The Sunni population of Iraq is very much and has been very much in support of the Shia-led government, because the Shia-led government was responsible for eradicating ISIS from areas that primarily Sunni people lived. But what's interesting now is that it's probably true to say that the people in the streets are primarily Shia, but that's more a matter of geography. It's just where they live in the south in Baghdad. But in Baghdad, it's a mixed group of people. According to polling, again, there is support for the protests in the Sunni-dominated areas of Iraq and around Mosul and western Iraq. There actually is support for these protests. They don't go out on the streets as much because I think that they are a minority in the country. They're careful. You know, they don't want to be singled out as troublemakers. But I think there's broad support. But again, they're looking for governance solutions. They don't want a sectarian solution. They know that replacing Prime Minister Adil Abdul Mahdi, he's not really particularly the problem. I mean, replacing him with yet another Shia politician is not going to solve the problem, and everyone kind of knows that. So they're not asking, as Ellen said, they're not asking for another person just to split up the pie differently. They want fundamental change. They talk about a technocratic government, by which they mean a government of experts that aren't political or sectarian. It's a little debatable because perhaps they already have that. I think the people in place are probably technocrats, but they're still controlled by the sectarian parties. So they're looking for something that actually moves the country forward. I've talked to many Iraqis, and they are sick and tired of living in a place that they themselves would describe as politically backwards. They want to join the rest of the world. They want a modern economy, a modern government, and they realize that the sectarian structures they have are not going to get that kind of modern reform that they're really looking for.
Back to you, Ellen Lapson. That's really an overhaul, is what he's saying, that these protesters want. But that's going to be difficult in the short run. We'll get back to that. But to what extent does Iran play into this? Because we're hearing these slogans, Iran get out. They're certainly backing many of the militias. How important is Iran's role?
So it's interesting. The messages that are coming from Iran are Iran is a status quo power. You know, they want things to just everybody settle down. They want to support the current government. They're saying, you know, we don't need this disruptive change and these folks in the street are troublemakers. So how interesting that they feel like the current arrangement is satisfactory from their perspective. And I'm sure they're rattled by the fact that even Shia Iraqis are openly saying we want less Iranian influence in our government. It is ironic, and I agree with Les, that actually the current lineup of the president and the prime minister, these are, you know, relatively less tainted and more reform-minded individuals. Barham Saleh, the Kurdish president, and Adel Abdel Mahdi, who is a political independent. He's not actually embedded right now in one of the political parties. So these guys probably would be willing to engage as much as possible in how do we accelerate the process of constructive change. But the protesters are so angry that they're asking for, you know, the total deconstruction of the political system. And that is very frightening to other Iraqis, I think, will feel that what they don't want is chaos, what they don't want is civil war. So how do you manage a process of change that doesn't turn out to make things even worse? So you could have, if the protesters were to succeed, man the barricades and tear it down, their lives would get worse, not better. And so I do think there are currently serving political actors in Iraq that are hearing the demands, but it's a political culture that will make it exceedingly difficult to create a new consensus over what's needed. They could agree to have a new constitutional commission that would redraft a new constitution. All of that would be possible if there was enough political consensus among the main parties. And so far, there's no reason to believe that's the case.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Ellen Lapson, from whom you just heard. She's professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, and Les Campbell. He's senior associate and regional director for Middle East and North Africa programs at the National Democratic Institute. We're comparing and contrasting the nature and impact of nationwide protests in Iraq and Lebanon. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener from Lagos, Nigeria, Sunday Ekpo. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our guests and our discussion about Iraq and Lebanon. Let's turn to Lebanon, Les Campbell. You were just there. And talk about what's driving those protests and the fact that, obviously, the sectarian government that was established since 1990, the end of the civil war, is part of the grievance. They also, in Lebanon, just like in Iraq, want to see a different form of government. And how realistic is that?
Lebanon is really an interesting spot right now, although I have to say that it's not terribly uncommon for Lebanese to protest. This is, you know, they like protesting. I think we have to make that point, that they do hit the streets. They have wonderful protests, very colorful. But before just getting more into that, I wanted to continue on this point of Iran. I think it is a really interesting point here, and Ellen mentioned this. I do have to mention, though, the irony of Iran, number one, being the loudest voice against, quote, foreign interference in Iraq and Lebanon. So the greatest foreign interferer of them all in Iraq and Lebanon is constantly, the last couple of weeks, giving out these dire warnings about foreign interference. And it's not lost on the Iraqis and Lebanese. They're laughing at this. I mean, they realize how ridiculous it is that this country that is trying to control their politics is warning about foreign interference, number one. And I think there is very little foreign presence or interference. I think these protests are primarily homegrown, really coming out of grievances that have been building for a long time. So there is something funny about this claim of foreign interference, and it's the pot calling the kettle black. Mm-hmm. But the second part, as Ellen mentioned, there's also this kind of amusing, if it weren't so sad, kind of attitude come out of Iran that, you know, the status quo is good. You know, what's wrong with you? The existing governments are fine. Just leave things alone. They're reformers. This is the message out of Lebanon over the weekend, was all the political leaders spoke, you know, recently and one after the other. I think the first to speak was President Michel Aoun saying, I'm a reformer. I hear you. I'm doing everything I can. It's really not me. Look at the Prime Minister. Well, the Prime Minister, Saad Hariri, had already stepped down, and he said to President Aoun, you know, I've stepped aside. It's up to you to take the lead. Well, then Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, spoke, and for very rare for him, instead of having a Hezbollah flag behind him, he almost never has a Lebanese flag anywhere near him, he had just a blue screen, which for Hezbollah was actually a change, a kind of a recognition that having a Hezbollah flag would maybe have riled the protesters. But then he said, I'm a reformer. I hear the people. I think someone else should react. And then you had Nabi Berri, the Speaker of the Parliament, spoke the next day saying, literally, I'm a reformer. I hear the people on the street. Someone else should act. So they're all, it's kind of a circular thing. They're pointing at one another, but no one's willing to really make a change. And then the irony was, is that the kind of official Iranian press is saying, the government of Lebanon must stay as it is. You know, any change to the government of Lebanon has to be negotiated. In other words, they have a vested interest in the structure of the government. Iraq is roughly the same way. I think Iran would probably say the same thing. If there's going to be a change in the structure of the Iraq government, Iran would want to be consulted about that. So you can't take Iran out of this equation. And again, I think in Iraq and Lebanon, people are saying, sick and tired of my life being controlled by these outside forces. I just want to have a better life, a better living, a better job. I want my money in the bank to be safe. I want my wages to mean something. I don't want prices to go up.
Well, Ellen, let me ask you then about Iran's influence. How much influence and control does it have over Iraq's government and Lebanon's government, respectively, if these protests keep going and the protesters, as you both said, are quite a cross-section? They may be predominantly youthful, but they represent a cross-section of people in their respective countries and sentiment. And they have patience. So I just want to know, how far is Iran willing to go to maybe maintain the status quo? And do each of the governments have enough independence to maybe go in a different direction in contrast to what Iran would like?
Well, I think it's a great question, and I think we will have to watch this play out. Iran has had a privileged position in both of those countries for quite a long time. I mean, literally being the power behind the scene that sort of selects which politicians are going up and down, clearly training and equipping these militia that have really, and I think it's important that we call attention to the fact that the physical violence in the Iraq case is much worse than in Lebanon. I mean, they're shooting to the heads of protesters. I mean, they are killing people, and it's a very more than disturbing sign that the government doesn't have enough authority over these militia to change the rules of engagement. So Iran has insinuated itself, first of all, that has physical proximity in Iraq. Iran is the food supplier and the oil supply, you know, their energy, they swap energy for refining purposes, etc. So there's a very strong interdependence between Iraq and Iran. But the Iranians have maybe overconfident and overplayed their hand, that they may think that they have this extraterritorial authority over these countries, and now they're being told, you know, back off. So it is interesting. Think of how much time the U.S. government and other friendly governments spend monitoring Iran's nefarious activities in the region. Is this a turning point? Is this a point where Iran has maxed out on how much it can interfere or manipulate its clients in these two key countries, and whether the Iranians are going to learn that they have to, you know, scale it back a little bit?
And to you, Les Campbell, since you were just in Lebanon, how important is the necessity or the desire to change this power-sharing system in Lebanon among the Shia, Sunni, and Christians, which, of course, you just said Iran says is just great, it should remain? And how much of their grievances revolve around that, in addition to the economic ones? And maybe the two are just simply intertwined.
Well, they're definitely intertwined. I was going to make also a comment again on this Iran issue, that in Lebanon, I think for a lot of people, having Iran play such a large role in the politics of the country would probably be more acceptable if Iran were the kind of country that were going to make giant loan guarantees of $10 or $20 billion, or if they were going to shore up the economy or just give money or invest in the central bank $25 billion for liquidity. They don't do anything like that. So Lebanon, its debt to GDP ratio is about 150% debt to GDP. So Iran interferes in the politics, but it doesn't have the kind of wealth that would be required to actually fix the economy. So it's kind of the worst of both worlds. You know, lots of interference, very little concrete help. But in terms of fixing the system, it's much easier said than done. One of the complications that came up is that as soon as we're talking to a senior advisor to a senior minister from a Christian group, and he reminded us in a very emotional way that Lebanon has a large number of Sunni Syrian refugees. And he said, Sunni Syrian refugees. The Sunni Syrian refugees live in predominantly Sunni parts of Lebanon, Tripoli. They're worried, I think wrongly, but there's some worry among the Christians that they could become citizens and change the balance in terms of the numbers of Lebanese. You know, there could be more Sunni Lebanese opposed to the Christians. There's always kind of an existential issue in Lebanon in terms of the Christian sects versus the Sunnis versus the Shia. So as soon as you start to get to proposing answers, the conversation quickly breaks down into emotional, very heartfelt, I might say, emotional things, because they had a civil war not that long ago. People who are over 55, most of the political leaders are easily over that age, they remember the Civil War. So as soon as you start talking about making changes, they think that violence could occur. The young people who don't remember the Civil War very much, they want changes, but to actually make those changes and change perhaps the balance of power in the country will be very tough.
And let's remind our listeners that Hezbollah is basically a creation of Iran.
Right. Iran is the patron, and very recently, I think right in the height of the protests, Hezbollah claimed that Israel sent a drone to Nabatea town in the south, which is Hezbollah-dominated, and that kind of ginned up some excitement, although I really doubt that Israel's trying to start a war right in the middle of this time right now. But anyway, as soon as that happens, then people kind of rally to the Hezbollah flag. Iran kind of plays up that part of it. They give them weapons. And, I mean, Lebanon, I mean, it's kind of a cliche to say, but it's unbelievably complicated. However, I think you cannot get past the fact that people are sick and tired of living in a dysfunctional state. The answer is either reform or people will try to emigrate. And who emigrates? Well, usually the educated people and people with a lot of potential.
Well, Ellen, we don't have much time. You get the last word to discuss how you see this going forward, the protests in both places and the implications thereof.
Well, so one of the observations about the protests is that we don't see a coherent leadership. They're not trying to name themselves a new political party or a new political movement. So in the absence of leadership, most likely it will peter out over time, particularly in the case of Iraq with the use of such heavy-handed tactics by the security forces. And that will not be a happy ending. I mean, that will not mean that they've sort of lost their interest in what they were demonstrating for. The burden will then be on this semi-corrupt or complacent political class to decide whether they can actually engage their own public. But over the long run, I am still encouraged by how many people in the Arab world want to be treated as citizens. They care about their country. and they care about their rights as individuals, but they also are moving in the direction of being a citizen in a more secular national sense and not be bound or limited by the particular subnational culture to which they were born. So that, in the long run, is a building block towards a more democratic future, I think.
Well, on that optimistic note, that's all the time we have on this edition of the program, but we will revisit the protests in Iraq and Lebanon in the weeks and months to come. I'd like to thank my guest, Ellen Lapson. She's professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, and Les Campbell, regional director for Middle East and North Africa programs at the National Democratic Institute. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guests. Our engineer was Wagner Roberts. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.